it is really fundamentally an American.
No more!
Drug war!
No more!
Drug war!
No more!
Drug war!
No more!
Broadcasting from the gulag city of planet Earth, this is Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth about the drug war. My name is Dean Becker. Our engineer is Steve Nolan. And tonight promises to be a jam-packed show, and I want to jump right into it.
I'm proud to welcome our guest for the evening, Jack Cole of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Good evening, Jack.
Good evening.
Retired officer, is it?
I'm a retired lieutenant from New Jersey State Police.
Yes, sir. There's much to get into about Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, but tell us, what is the purpose of your organization?
Our organization is Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, or LEAP, and it was created to give voice to all the current and former members of law enforcement who feel like the war on drugs is a dismal, abject failure, and who would want to support alternative policies, policies that will do four things, that will lower the incidence of death, disease, crime, and addiction by ultimately ending prohibition.
When you and I first met, I kind of showed a little bit of incrementalism, wanting to talk more about medical marijuana, perhaps, and so forth. But you guys are for ending prohibition outright. Is that correct?
Outright, yes. And that can only mean one thing. It means legalizing all drugs. Legalizing them so that we can control and regulate them and keep them out of the hands of our children, something that the war on drugs has been incapable of doing for 33 years at the cost of $500 billion.
You gave me a bumper sticker a little earlier on that said drugs are too dangerous to leave in the hands of criminals. Discuss that thought.
Well, that's exactly what our thought is. Drugs are too dangerous to leave in the hands of criminals, and right now they are in the hands of criminals. At LEAP, we feel that there's only three possible models of who can control and regulate drugs in the United States. There's a government model. There's a free market model, and there's the Al Capone model. And it's been the Al Capone model that we've been using for 33 years. And the Al Capone model is basically donate $400 billion a year to your local gangster, murderer, and terrorist, because that's how much money is spent in the world on illicit drugs, $400 billion a year.
Yes, sir. And the government is now trying to draw some sort of involvement. If you use drugs, you support terrorism. But is it not the policy itself that lends support to the terrorists?
That's exactly what it is, certainly. They would like you to believe that if some little kid smokes a joint, they're supporting terrorism. But the true people who knowingly or unknowingly are, in my estimation, supporting terrorism are the people who either pass the legislation or vote for the legislation that keeps the war on drugs continuing as it is. Because if we ended the war on drugs today and legalized all drugs tomorrow, there wouldn't be a terrorist in the world who would make a single penny on them.
You know, Jack, I heard an earlier discussion of yours, and you talked about in the early days, as the war on drugs was ramping itself into full existence, that there was some, I don't know, fudging of data, etc., that you guys did back then?
I like that, Dean. Fudging of data. What we did basically was we lied about everything. The war on drugs was a lie to begin with. It was created in 1968. It was coined and created by Richard Milhouse Nixon. And it had almost nothing to do with drugs. It was created in order to garner votes for him to run for the presidency, because he felt that if he were running as a strong anti-crime person, that would get him a lot of votes. But boy, if he could be in charge of a war. And it worked, of course. As we all know, he was elected. And in his first year in office, he managed to get Congress to pass massive funding bills to give tremendous amounts of money to any police department willing to hire officers to fight his war on drugs. And to give you a slight idea how massive these were, the New Jersey State Police at the time had 1,700 people in their organization. We had a seven-man narcotic unit when I went in 1964. In 1970, when I went into narcotics myself, I went in with a whole lot of people because in October 1970, we went from a seven-man unit to a 76-person bureau overnight, one step, and it was all done on the federal tax dollar. Not a single penny came out of local or state government, which meant tremendous amounts of money and power going into the administrators of these police departments.
It is kind of mind-boggling the amount of money that through the decades that we have spent on this, not just given to the drug lords, as you said earlier, but that we have spent giving to law enforcement. What kind of dollars?
We need to follow that thread, if I may, for just a moment.
Yeah.
Because due to that fact, when we hit the streets, we were trained for 2 weeks, and then they designated one-third of the 76 of us as undercover agents, and I happened to fall in that, and that's where I spent most of the next 14 years of my life. But when we hit the streets, we were supposed to arrest people for selling drugs. That's what we were out there for. That was a very hard job in 1970 for a couple reasons. First reason was we had no idea how to fight a war on drugs, and neither did our bosses. But our bosses did know one thing. They knew how to keep milking this federal cash cow in their own barnyard, because they had to, now that they'd hired 76 people, they had to pay them every year forever. And since this was all federal money, they had to show how this war was absolutely necessary in order to keep this money coming in. Okay? Now let me tell you what the war on drugs was like in 1970. We didn't have much of a war or much of a drug problem at all in 1970. It was more a nuisance, really, than anything else. Certainly nothing that I think should have even had police intervention, let alone a war on drugs, thinking about it today. And what I mean by that is, for instance, deaths caused by drug culture. In 1970, you were less likely to die as a result of the drug culture in this country than you were to die from falling down your own steps in your own house. Less likely to die of the drug culture than you would choking to death on your own food at dinner. And as far as I know, we haven't started a war on stairways or dinner yet, but who knows? We still have time. So this wasn't really much of a problem, but it was a problem to us because when we hit the streets, there weren't a whole lot of drug dealers out there, and the drugs that were out there were almost entirely what we called soft drugs, marijuana, hashish, some LSD, psilocybin, mushrooms type thing. Hard drugs like methamphetamine, cocaine, heroin were practically non-existent in 1970, certainly non-existent compared to what they are today. So this caused us quite a dilemma. How are we going to show that this war is an absolute necessity so our bosses can keep this money coming in? And our bosses had the answer to that. As you say, they may have said fudge a little. They said maybe we could inflate these statistics a little. They gave us every go-ahead to lie, and lie we did. We lied about everything we did in the first year. We inflated everything we did. let me explain how we did that. First, we were looking for drug dealers, and since we couldn't just find a whole lot of drug dealers, what we did was we sent our undercover people in to infiltrate small groups of friendship groups, 10 to 15 people, maybe in college kids or high school kids or kids in between. Back then, we had a lot of hippies around, and they were all using soft drugs. And they were also doing something that the administration didn't like at all. They were protesting the Vietnam War. So we could pretty much do what we wanted to with those folks. And what we did was we infiltrated those groups. I remember one of the first ones I infiltrated, and everybody was doing this. I was working about 30 miles outside of Manhattan. Back then, Manhattan was the main place you went to get drugs because it just wasn't everywhere like it is today. So I get into the friendship group, and the idea, let me segue into this, the idea of an undercover agent is not this romantic thing that you see on television and the movies. An undercover agent's job is really pretty despicable, because my job, every agent's job, was to do, when we're targeted against someone, our job is to do whatever is necessary to become that person's closest friend, their best confidant, so that we can betray them and send them to jail. And as soon as we finish with that one, we're off to the next. So it becomes friendship, betrayal, jail, over and over and over, repeated hundreds and hundreds of times. Over 1,000 young folks went to jail as a direct result of my undercover work. People went to jail for nothing more than the fact that they wanted to put something in their body that I didn't want to put in my body. But let's go back now to how we did this. We got this group of 10 to 15 people, and come Friday night, they're just like other people. Somebody says, hey, you want to get high? And if some of them answer yes, then one of them will say, well, I've got access to the family car or something. I'll make the run to the city tonight. So y'all give me your money and give me a list of what you want me to buy, and I'll buy it and bring it back. So somebody might ask for a couple joints or a dime bag of pot or give me a couple mushrooms or whatever. And I'd put in my order, which was just as small, and give them a few bucks, not much. And this person would make the run to the city. When they came back, they would just hand it out. Now, they didn't get money for this. Probably didn't even get gas money, right? They just figured this is a friendship thing. A week later, it might be person B that did it, and a week after that, person C, and a week after that, person D. Well, I hung around until I had them all. And after we were infiltrating groups like this everywhere in a community. So after a couple months, we'd have maybe 90, 95 people that we had got drugs from. And by the way, they didn't even have to do what I just said. Just the mere fact that they would, as a friend, and you know drug use is a very social thing, especially soft drugs, take two tokes and pass it on, right? Well, if they passed it to me, I would pretend to take a toke, knock the flame off the end of that joint, and put it in my pocket, and then that night it would be submitted as evidence, and they would become a drug dealer. Okay? So that's right. So by the end of a couple months, we would round these people up. We'd have maybe 90, 95 of them, and we'd send in 350 cops at 5 o'clock in the morning, kick their doors down. And we did. We kicked all their doors down. We did it for a purpose. We did it because this was very important to us to show them street justice, you know, to frighten them away from using drugs, because after all, the courts were not treating them nearly harsh enough in our minds. So we would kick their doors down, drag them out in chains, and back then they were charged with distribution of controlled dangerous substance, which in 1970 was exactly the same charge, because we didn't have weights attached to it or anything attached to it as far as which substance was which. So they could have sold me a kilo of heroin. They're getting the same charge. And the charge would have put them in prison for 7 years. So by the end of the first year, we had all kinds of drug dealers that we were releasing to the media. It looked like this was the worst problem in America, right? And it wasn't just that we lied about. We also lied about the amounts of drugs we seized. The way we did that was, back then, as I told you, hard drugs were almost non-existent. So a decent seizure for a local police department or a state police department might be 1 ounce of cocaine or 1/4 ounce of heroin, believe it or not. Yeah. But when we'd go in and we'd seize maybe 1 ounce of cocaine in a house, we'd look around to see if there's any cutting agent there, quinine, milk, sugar, lactose. And if we found any cutting agent somewhere between where we seized the ounce of cocaine, say we found 4 pounds of cutting agent, somewhere between where we seized the ounce of cocaine and the state lab, that magically all became cocaine, which is very simple. You just accidentally drop the small package in the big package and shake it once. As far as the state's concerned, that is all cocaine. Our bosses are very happy. We're happy. Everyone goes home happy, except maybe the poor slob that just got arrested.
You used the word, and I'm going to gleefully use it here. This behavior is despicable.
What can these police officers in Houston that are involved in what I consider to be a very corrupt scenario, what we have going here with a crime lab and sending so many people to prison, what can you tell those guys? What can they do to help end this madness?
What can I tell the police down there?
Yeah.
Well, I could tell them that, first off, you have to treat these people as human beings, because that's exactly what they are. We were trained with this metaphor of a war on drugs. So we were trained as officers to go to war. And when a person is trained to go to war, the sad thing is they have to have an enemy. And the enemy becomes the citizens of the United States, the population of the United States. And it truly is the population of the United States, because according to the government statistics now, they say 87 million people in this country above the age of 12 have used an illegal drug. So every one of those is vulnerable to arrest. So the enemy is us. This is not a war on drugs. It's a war on people. It's a war on our children, a war on our parents, a war on ourselves. And it's got to stop. But even if they didn't stop it, they could at least get this in their minds that this isn't an enemy, this is us. So maybe they could treat them a little better, maybe they would be more honest in their dealings with them, more honest at least in the way they catch people and they testify truthfully about it and such. But none of that is going to correct any of this. The only thing that's going to correct this is what we at LEAP are fighting for. And that is an end to prohibition, just like when we ended alcohol prohibition. And the point isn't that when I go out to talk to civic groups and professional groups, I tell them the point isn't that ending drug prohibition will end the drug problem. It may not end the drug problem. As a matter of fact, it won't end the drug problem. And I also tell them, because I don't want to argue with them about it, I say, well, drugs may be every bit as bad as you think they are. They may be worse than you think they are. But drugs, no drug in the history of the world has ever become better by prohibiting it. All that ever happens when you prohibit something is you create an underground market that artificially inflates the value of that product so huge that people are willing to murder each other in the street in order to control their own territory. And when I say so huge, the value of this product, which is only weeds, that's all we're talking about. I don't care whether you're talking about marijuana from a hemp plant, cocaine from a coca bush, or heroin from an opium poppy. It's just weeds. Those of us charged with destroying it go out and we cut it down, we pull it up by the roots, we spray it, fumigate it. We got to go back year after year because it just keeps coming back and back. It'll grow literally any place in the world. And because it is so prolific, it has zero value. No value at all until we say it's prohibited. And then the value goes right through the ceiling. So much so that between where it's grown, maybe in Afghanistan or Colombia, and where it's sold in Los Angeles or New York, that value can increase by 17,000%. Now, I would submit to anybody out there listening that when there is that kind of obscene profit to be made, whole armies of police officers can't stop this. We cannot arrest our way out of it. I learned very early out there living on the streets with those folks that if a uniformed cop arrested somebody for murder or rape, they were taking someone off the streets. It made our community safer for all of us. But if I arrested someone for selling drugs, all I was doing was creating a job opening for 200 poor people that were more than willing to jump in that line.
Okay, we're going to take a real quick break and be right back. It's time to play Name That Drug by Its Side Effects. Bulimia, anxiety, excessive urination, the inability to drive a car or operate complex machinery, migraine headache, brain seizures. Time's up. The answer, Wellbutrin, another FDA-approved product. You're listening to Cultural Baggage on the Drug Truth Network, and our guest for this evening is retired police officer Jack Cole.
It's very important that people understand not only here in the U.S., but many members of LEAP have joined in this effort around the world trying to change this.
Absolutely.
What is your website? Maybe they could learn from that.
Oh, they could certainly learn from that. We're at www.leap, L-E-A-P, for Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, www.leap.cc. We started just 1 year ago with five founding members, all of whom were current or former cops. And we've created an organization that was modeled after the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, because we felt that those people had such credibility when they went out to talk against the Vietnam War, because they'd been there, they'd been in the trenches, and it's very hard to argue with somebody that's been there who comes home and says, look, I did all that, I fought my heart out, I put my life on the line, and we're wrong, we've got to end it. And we truly believe in what we're doing. Nobody at LEAP gets paid for anything we do. We do it because we believe in it, and we went from those five founding members to over 700 members today in slightly over a year.
Wow.
We have over 50 speakers living in 25 of the United States in five different countries. And if we, you know, if we go one more year like this, we'll be monstrous in size, and I think that'll happen. The main people we talk to so far, we haven't been out talking to police or anything. We've been talking to civic groups, professional groups, education, religious groups, people who already, most of them were in favor of having a war on drugs. And it's our reception has been nothing short of spectacular. And we're sure that we're carrying 80% of our audience that agree with us. And sometimes I carry 100%. I've had standing ovations from getting up in front of rotaries and saying, we have to legalize all drugs, legalize them so that we can control them, regulate them, and keep them out of the hands of our children. You know, the drug warriors say, we're going to end this problem. They've been saying it for 33 years, right? And now they've got another new thing that says, what, 2 years, we're going to cut it down by so many percent, 5 years, so many percent. We can't even keep drugs out of maximum security prisons. How do we ever expect to keep them out of our schools with this policy? Can't do it.
I see great similarities to the continual five-year plans that the Russians used to present, you know, and that never succeeded, but the five-year plan brought credibility.
Put it far enough in the future that the people in office at that time didn't have to answer for it, and that's what's happening here, sure.
There's been the scandals at John Hopkins where they, I won't say falsified, but there was sure some incorrect data developed. And, you know, we got the Dallas Sheetrock scandal, and we got the Tulia scandal, and all of this bad science, bad information, bad usage of law, and yet somehow they're able to validate it in the state house. They're afraid, aren't they? I understand most of the people I talk to want to end this drug war, but they're waiting on the citizens to tell them to end it. Is that a fair assumption?
I think that's a very fair assumption. And as I just said, the citizens that hear us talk, we're carrying 80% of them. And let me explain to you something about these groups, because these are amazing groups, and we love to talk to them. Take a Rotary, for instance. The members of a Rotary are some pretty upstanding citizens in the community. They're fairly large business people, or mayors and people in the city council, professional folks, educators. They're pretty solid citizens, and they are members of a civic group, which means right away that they want to help their community, right? There are also people who, for the most part, believe that drugs are terrible and the war on drugs is the way we should do it. And most of them, almost all of them, don't even know I'm going to speak about drug policy when I come in, because these folks are going to be sitting in that seat every Wednesday at noon or whatever their appointed time is, because that's their job with the Rotary. They don't really care who's going to be speaking or what they're speaking about. So over and over again, after I get done speaking, I hear almost the same words. People come up to me and say, Jack, when I came in here today and I saw what was on the agenda to be discussed, drug policy, legalizing drugs, I thought you must be nuts. But I got to admit, you've convinced me. And I hear it over and over and over. We're changing the minds of the people on the other side. And we're doing it in 30 minutes. And it's not because I'm a good speaker. It's not because any of us are particularly good speakers. It's because, for one thing, we have the credibility that they will at least open their ears and listen, okay? But the main thing is what they hear is the truth, and it's the first time they've ever heard the truth. And once you hear the truth, you hear that we spent $500 billion in 33 years to end this war, and all we've done is destroy countless millions of lives. 1.6 million people we arrest every year for nonviolent drug arrests, and 2.2 million people in prison, the vast majority of whom are there for nonviolent drug arrests. 2.2 million people are sitting in prison right now as we're sitting in this room. And let me put that in context. The United States only has the population of 4.6% of the population of the world. But we have 22.5% of its prisoners in this land of freedom. Now, there's something wrong with that picture to me. And the saddest thing about all this is that with all this money we spent, all this heartache we've caused, all these lives destroyed, all this hard work of our police officers, today drugs are cheaper, they're more potent, and they're easier to get than they were 33 years ago when I started buying them on the streets of New Jersey. Now that, to me, is the very essence of a failed public policy. And I'm sure some of your listeners are old enough to remember Will Rogers. One of the great things he said that I love is he said, you know, if you find yourself in a hole, probably the first thing you should do is stop digging. So that's all we're suggesting we do at LEAP. Let's stop digging in this hole of the war on drugs and look for alternative policies.
Jack Cole, I want to thank you for hopefully opening a few eyes and a couple of ears and making us take another look at this. And I do want to thank you so much for being part of the Cultural Baggage Show.
You're very welcome, and you're doing a great job here. I'm just really pleased to be on. I'm pleased to be here, and I'm pleased to be old enough and secure enough in my life to stand up here and tell the truth about the war on drugs.
Judge James P. Gray has taken a leave of absence from his legal duties to run for the Senate in the state of California. Judge Gray is dogged in his long-held belief that drug legalization is the only way to solve what he says is an increasingly unsuccessful war on drugs. So therefore, this week we name Judge Gray as our Drug War Hero of the Week. Okay, well, I'm hoping you'll join us next time on Cultural Baggage when our guest will be Dr. Mitch Earlywine, the author of Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence. With his in-depth yet common-sense approach, Dr. Mitch will be sure to enlighten us all. And as always, because of drug prohibition, I remind you, you don't know what's in that bag, and please, be careful. For the Drug Truth Network, and on behalf of my technical producer, Steve Nolan, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth. This show is produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston,